A lab-coated technician looked up from what appeared to be a modern version of an electron microscope.
Yes, Sergeant?
Excuse me, comrade. The weapons brought in with the male and female prisoner. Captain Fyodorovich has requested that I examine them for a moment.
The weapons will be examined in due course, Sergeant.
But, comrade, the woman has revealed that secret information is concealed under the grip panels of each of the handguns. Putting the individual elements together will provide us with the valuable data that is vital to security of the submarine pens.
The technician's expression changed from irritation to puzzlement.
It is vital, comrade.
Yeah, very well. I have them here.
The technician started toward a bank of plastic-looking locking cabinets. Rourke glanced through the doors toward the corridor. No one was coming, yet. The technician opened one of the plexiglass cabinets.
They are here, and I believe they are unloaded, but I can assume no responsibility for that. Weapons are not my department.
Certainly, comrade. The ammunition?
Rourke stopped before the open cabinet. The twin stainless Detonix 45s lay side by side. The magazines were withdrawn, but he could tell they were at least partially loaded, seeing brass through some of the upper witness holes. He picked up one of the pistols and jacked back the slide, raising the slide stop. He stuffed what looked like the Fuller magazine up the butt.
What are you doing, Sergeant?
Rourke thumbed down the slide stop, the top round stripped from the magazine and chambered as he turned to face the technician.
I am pointing a loaded 5 centuries old 45 caliber automatic at your testicles. Where is the rest of it?
Rourke jerked his head toward the cabinet.
I do not...
Allow me to assure you that such a gun as this will not numb you or put you to sleep. It will rip your genitals from your body, and you will die in considerable pain and not all too quickly. Where, comrade?
Rourke punched the muzzle of the little Detonix against the man's crotch.
The next cabinet.
Open it.
Rourke turned around with the man, the muzzle of his pistol less than 2 inches from the man's body. The technician opened another plexiglass cabinet. Natalia's revolvers, her speed loaders, her Balisong folding knife, her holsters, his AG Russell Sting 1A knife, his compass, the contents of his musette bag, the Spark six-pack of spare magazines for the little pistols all lay carefully placed in the bin.
All is in order, comrade. Now, the prison, that way.
Rourke gestured to his left.
Yes, that...
Rourke guided him the rest of the way to the hard floor. He had, after all, been cooperative. Rourke slung the musette bag crossbody, filled the gym bag with his guns and Natalia's, put the little Sting 1A black chrome inside the boot top of his stolen footgear and his grain knife onto his uniform belt. He looked at the unconscious lab technician.
Sleep tight. Thank you.
Rourke smiled and darted for the door. Paul Rubinstein, slightly uncomfortable in his tight Soviet uniform, for more reasons than just its fit, was supposed to be the enlisted man, so it meant that he drove the half-track vehicle. Michael sat beside him in the truck's front seat. Michael was uniformed as a captain, and the fit of Michael's uniform was much better.
What's so funny, Paul?
Before the night of the war, I saw this play once. A musical. Man of La Mancha, about a...
Don Quixote, by Cervantes. I read it.
Yeah. Yeah, so did I. I remember the character of Sancho Panza?
And?
I was just thinking, we sidekicks never get the best outfits, do we?
Paul gestured broadly over his uniform.
Sidekick?
You know, Tonto, Pat Buttram, Smiley Burnett, Sancho Panza, like that.
I know who Tonto was, of course, and Sancho Panza.
Yeah, same idea, I suppose. I'm your dad's sidekick, think about it. I never much thought of myself as comedy relief, though. More like Tonto, faithful.
He was an American Indian.
You didn't know? He was from the Lost Tribe of Israel. His last name was Goldfarb. His tribe wore braids instead of forelocks, that's all. And all the ones who wore broad-brimmed black hats.
Yeah, your dad's sidekick. His faithful Jewish companion. On loan at the moment.
And you get no wholesale rates from me. Think this will ever end, Michael?
You mean the whole thing? The war?
Yeah. I started keeping a diary right after the crash there in New Mexico. Before that, really. On a plane when I figured I was probably gonna die. Your dad and I got together and he taught me how to ride and shoot. So what if there were motorcycles and automatic weapons instead of horses and six guns? Your father's a good man. The best. he's dead, we find out who, well, you know. If he is, you're gonna have to move awful fast and beat me to the bastard. You know what I mean, Michael?
Michael Rourke only nodded. Paul Rubinstein's eyes returned to the track they followed, a road of sorts, but only by dint of use. The snow all but gone here, the ruts deep. He imagined they would get deeper when the weather warmed, if that ever happened. Ahead, he could see the gates in the outer deflection barrier. Michael called to Maria Leuden and Otto Hammerschmidt in the rear of the truck.
Watch out, we're hitting the first guard post.
Are you sure you've got it right?
No, but we'll find out, won't we?
Paul began braking, the controls of the half-track truck at first difficult to master, a cross between the German mini-tanks and a standard truck in practice. But the vehicle was slowing smoothly enough. Paul was suddenly seized with mild panic. Karamazov's army numbered in the thousands, but what if this guard post harbored someone who had a terrific memory for faces and didn't remember seeing a captain who looked like Michael Rourke? But at Michael's salute, the guard raised the barrier. Paul eased the vehicle forward, not wanting to appear too eager. The truck moved forward smoothly. They were inside. Paul thought that it was probably true. The Lord watched over fools, drunks, and Irishmen. And now add to that, Jewish sidekicks. Olaf Karenin's head pounded with pain. His left arm and side, like his head, were bandaged. The arm, the result of a brush with death from one of the sharks. The side, a knife wound bestowed by Rourke. He leaned heavily against the side of the gull wing.
Where is he?
He hammered his good right fist against the vehicle's roof. Boris Fyodorovich watched beside him.
Olaf, you should rest. I can settle this matter.
What did you learn?
Very well, gunshots, live ammunition. As you suspected, he has evidently penetrated the security complex.
I increased the guard! How could—
There have been several personnel found already whom he shot with sedative darts. There is substantial reason to believe he is dressed as one of us.
But how substantial?
Three of our personnel were found in the hedges not far from Monorail Station 17. Two of them stripped of their uniforms, and a third—
Two?
One of the Spetsnaz stripped of his uniform is a male of approximately the same height as this Wolfgang Heinz or whoever he is. The other guard was a female, approximately the same size as the female prisoner. I checked. May I suggest—
What?
May I suggest, Comrade Major, that security be asked to put out search teams. We do not have enough Marine Spetsnaz personnel available to us to cover all three domes. If he has left the security complex, we will not know for several minutes more.
No. Coordinate from here. I go to my quarters. If he plans to attempt to free the woman, he will come there.
Karenin could not bring in security. The triumvirate could not learn that he, in fact, knew this Wolfgang Heinz to be the American John Rourke.
My quarters, quickly!
John Rourke pushed the door marked Medical Research inward, letting it swing. He could see a typical laboratory beyond, and with one of the Detonics pistols in each fist, he stepped through, dodging left. No one appeared to be inside. The lights were on. There was a strong smell, like acid. At the far end of the laboratory stood what looked to be more or less standard double doors, the kind that swung open and closed. Rourke started toward the doors, passing ranks of large plastic cabinets of the type in which his and Natalia's weapons had been kept. He reached the double doors, pushed open the left door, and dodged right. He was not ready for what lay before him.
Mother of God.
Before him stood rows upon rows of cages, and inside the cages, men languished in misery. Some were Chinese, others were not. White men, black men, some of them obviously in terrible condition, growths on their bodies, skin rashes covering large portions of their flesh, others with dazed expressions.
What are you planning for us now, you bastard?
John Rourke turned toward the sound of the voice. He saw a tall, well-built black man, whose clothes were some sort of uniform once, but now hung in rags. The color of his skin was gray, bespeaking poor health.
Russian is not your first language, and certainly not your best. What is your language? Fuck you!
John Rourke stepped to the cage.
Say that again, and as soon as you're well enough, I'll kick the shit out of you.
Rourke stopped before the cage.
The hell kind of trick is this?
You're an American?
Damn right I am, and proud of it.
That is music to my ears, buddy.
John Rourke began inspecting the lock on the cage.
Keys, where are they?
You really?
My name is John Rourke.
The uniform's borrowed. This bag is filled with Stye 20s and a couple of 357 Magnums. Ever heard of those?
The man didn't answer.
How about a 45?
Rourke gestured with the Detonix minigun in his left hand.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation,
under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
There were tears in the black man's eyes. Rourke felt a shiver along his spine.
I don't know where they keep the keys.
Then stand back. Take that mattress, cover yourself with it, and get in the corner of the cage. I'm shooting the lock. Go on, hurry!
The man drew back, catching up the mattress, taking shelter in the farthest corner of the cage as John Rourke leveled the Detonix toward the lock and stepped back a few paces. He took aim, averting his eyes slightly against the possibility of flying debris. Rourke looked toward the lock plate. It seemed heavily damaged.
Come on, buddy. Push!
Rourke grabbed a handful of bar and mesh, the man inside the cage bracing his right shoulder against it.
Now!
As Rourke pulled, the black man pushed. The lock snapped, and the cage door swung open. Rourke moved back to catch his balance. The black man almost sprang from the cage.
Who are you? You're not from Midwake.
I'm not from Midwake. I don't even know what Midwake is, except something that some of these Soviets are afraid of. I'm an American, and there are a few left like me. I can't take the time to explain it all now, and I don't feel like wasting ammunition on the rest of these cage doors. So, if you're up to it, look for the keys or a pry bar. You need help? Or can I stay by the door out there and wait for company with this?
Rourke raised the little Detonix 45 in his left hand, flicking up the safety.
I can do it.
Figured you could. Here.
Rourke dropped to his knees beside the gym bag. He took out a Stye 20. The man recoiled from it.
Take it. I'll put the rest out on the floor here. Watch out, though. They're not all fully loaded, and I haven't found a spare magazine in this whole damn place.
Rourke set the pistols out, caught up the bag in his right hand, and rose to his full height.
Thanks, I think.
He extended his right hand. He and Rourke shook.
You're welcome, I think.
Then he set off through the doors and across the laboratory to guard the main entrance to the lab. Olaf Karenin entered the room, and Natalia realized she had fallen into sleep, dreaming.
Major Chamarovna!
Would you unbind me? I have to go to the bathroom.
Your heroic John Rourke has temporarily escaped death.
I assumed he would. I still have to go to the bathroom.
Karenin had drawn the shades, or curtains, and the room was nearly dark.
I wish to have you for my woman.
Apparently you leave me little choice.
She tugged at the bonds at her wrists and ankles, holding her on her back in the bed.
I would make you take me now. But he will be coming here. If he makes it this far, I have men stationed everywhere. And I will wait for him myself outside this door. So I am afraid I cannot unbind you at this moment, Major Chamarovna. But after he is dead, before I must surrender you to your husband, Marshal Karamazov. I will have you.
And when I tell Vladimir, he will have you killed.
Somehow, Comrade Major Chamarovna, that does not matter to me at all.
He opened the door. The light beyond was bright and flooded over her on the bed. Then the door closed and the room was darker than before. Natalia closed her eyes.
Don't come for me, John. Save yourself.
Rourke detected movement at the end of the corridor, and the alarms within the prison were silent. He heard the prisoner's voice coming from behind him.
The alarm stopped.
They know I'm here.
Then we're trapped. Shit!
Yeah, but we have weapons, and we have this.
Rourke had been busy while he waited for the man he freed to release the other prisoners.
We're not being captured again, any of us.
We have this.
Rourke pointed toward a large plastic container on the laboratory table.
What's that smell?
This. Know anything about chemistry?
Not much.
In my day, to become a doctor of medicine, that's what I am by trade. I had to study chemistry. So I mixed a few chemicals I found here. That's a firebomb. But it won't do us much good if there isn't more than one way out of here.
The man looked toward the doors, then at the container of combustible chemicals.
Just deeper into the prison.
How many men are in there?
You mean... Yeah.
Rourke peered through the door into the corridor again.
We'll have to move fast. The men who don't have anything more than clubs can take charge of the men who can't move too well.
You're a doctor?
Yeah. But I used to be with the Central Intelligence Agency a long while back.
The newly liberated inmate laughed, but his eyes didn't.
You're bullshitting me. I read about the CIA. That's from before the Great War.
Is that what you call it?
Rourke moved the improvised firebomb nearer to the door.
At Midwake. Where is that?
You get us out of here, you'll find out. And I'm buying the first drink.
You're on. But after we clear the prison, there's somebody else I still have to free.
What's your name? I'd like to know who I'm drinking with.
John Rourke. How about yours?
Aldrich, Samuel Bennett, Captain, 1st Battalion Bravo Company out of Midwake, United States Marine Corps.
Rourke looked at him. He knew the look was odd.
I thought you guys were extinct.
Just been laying low, Doctor.
Well, get the guys up here, Sam. We got a boogie.
Aldridge arranged the men, separating them so the ones armed with Sty 20s were bunched together, and the ones armed only with blunt instruments were helping those who couldn't walk too well. They gathered round Rourke near the door, leading from the laboratory into the corridor.
All right, here's the plan. This jar has a combustible mixture in it. I'm gonna roll it into the corridor and toward our friends down there. Whoever best knows his way around the prison, take the lead in the opposite direction, because once that container is near enough to our Soviet friends, one bullet in it, and that thing is going to explode. Whoever the leader is, take off, and the rest of us will follow. We want to reach the main prison compound so we can spring the people in confinement and swell our ranks. Anything you come across that you or one of the guys we free can use as a weapon, grab it.
Not just guys, Dr. Rourke. They got some women down there, too. And they should be ready to fight like hell, because the guards like to...
I understand. Captain Aldrich, you get the honors. Give it a good roll. I'll cover you with ease.
Your hand. I can handle a regular firearm.
So can I. I spilled some acid on it as I made the concoction, but I dressed it and sprayed it. I'll be all right.
The Chinese man with bleeding gums and blistered arms stood beside the door. Aldrich opened the door. Rourke nodded. Aldrich shoved the container through, then turned it on its side. Nothing leaked out.
Now, Sam.
Rourke stepped into the doorway as Captain Sam Aldrich, U.S. Marine, started the 5-gallon jug rolling. Rourke responded to the Sty 20 fusillade with both pistols simultaneously. The normally moderate recoil of the little Detonix pistols sending a wave of pain through his right hand. Rourke tucked back in the laboratory and carefully aimed. Flames belched in all directions. Rourke stepped into the hallway, both pistols ready.
Sam! Take that bag and don't lose it. Now go for it!
Among the prisoners were whites and a few blacks, taken, Rourke learned, from Aldrich in the continuing war between the Russians and Midwake.
We've been fighting the Russians beneath the sea for centuries. Most of this group was captured on intelligence missions. Our vessels were destroyed at the same time.
I assume the Chinese prisoners were taken during the attacks by the mysterious raiders the Chinese authorities on the surface are fighting.
Yeah, you're probably right. We should find out more once we free the other prisoners.
Rourke stood on a tabletop to address the crowd of newly free men and women, eager to take the war to their Soviet captors.
Soon, there will be more security police, Marine Spetsnaz, more Soviet personnel coming than we can hope to handle. We must leave here at once, taking everything that can be useful as a weapon. Now, Sergeant Aitken will lead you to the submarine pens, and you can commandeer a vessel or vessels and try for this place called Midwake. You'll be safe there. We are all allies now. But the diversion you people will create will allow me to get to another part of the complex and attempt the rescue of my friend who is still a prisoner, with perhaps the same fate in store for her as they intended for you.
The 120 or so armed escapees, some of them showing the marks of repeated beatings and near starvation, fell silent.
If my friend and I reach the sub-pens in time, we'll join you, but don't wait for us. Just make as much mayhem as possible, and you'll help us best.
Freedom! 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 Freedom!
As they moved through the corridor, at each turn, expecting interception, Rourke queried Aldrich concerning the nature of the experiments conducted on the prisoners.
The Russians seem to love those dart guns of theirs, the Sty 20s. Best I can figure is they're working to come up with new poisons for them. I've actually seen prisoners strapped against a wall and then shot with as many as a half dozen rounds. Medical technicians check pulse rates, heart rates, stuff like that. Feng, the fellow with the bleeding gums.
Aldrich gestured toward the man who was their guide.
Feng was shot twice a day for better than a week. And the first day, his gums started bleeding.
What about the blisters on his arm? How'd he get them?
A different thing, I guess. Just regular injections. He got 2 injections, and then they just left him. And pretty soon, the blisters started appearing, and splitting, and there was pus and everything oozing out of his arms. We tried helping him by giving him part of our water rations, but when they realized we were doing that, they moved his cage further out so none of us could reach him. Then they put him in a smaller cage underneath two larger cages and took away the pots the guys above used for toilets. The guys tried, but after a while, they couldn't help it. And then the infections on his arms got worse, you know, and... They hate the Chinese. I guess because the Chinese fought against them during the Great War. They hate the Chinese more than they hate us. I don't know why, I don't know much, but I know none of us are ever going back inside.
The group was nearing the confluence of tunnels Rourke first saw when entering the security level. Their guide, Feng, stopped for a moment, apparently considering which of the tunnels to take.
If it's of any help, after I penetrated the security level, I reactivated the energy barrier.
Rourke knew they were being monitored. Security cameras buzzed and whirred as they walked into their scanning range. They were nearing the end of the tunnel.
Could those APCs they have get down here?
I don't think an armored personnel carrier would make it.
Sam, what's the thing they'll think we do?
Escape to the perimeter of the city. Why?
Let's try to outsmart them.
Rourke turned to their guide.
Feng, is there a route to get from this dome into the Institute for Marine Studies? And if there is, where is it?
Feng kept moving, sounding slightly out of breath from the exertion. Rourke was amazed that some of these men walked even this far. After a moment's consideration, the man looked at Rourke.
There is a service tunnel from the maintenance section above. It is very narrow. Prisoners were used in the maintenance service to replace piping sections that carried steam to the other domes. Because the work was considered very dangerous, some men died there. If a pipe were to break while we traveled through the tunnel, we could all die.
Rourke thought for a moment as they hustled along.
All right, this is what we do. Since we haven't encountered resistance so far, I'm going to assume they're waiting for us outside under the dome. If we get into the Institute for Marine Studies, is there a direct route into the subpens? Does anybody know?
Hey! I do!
Rourke turned toward the throng following him. A short woman with dark hair shouldered her way to the front of the mob.
I know. When they brought me here, they took me past the shark pens and they hung me in the water upside down. They almost drowned me. And then some of them... well...
You came out in marine studies?
Yeah. A lot of stuffed fish in a big marble hallway? Yeah.
When we get that far, you lead the way. What's your name?
Martha.
Martha. That good with you?
Yeah.
Her cheeks were darkly bruised, and part of her left earlobe had apparently been ripped or bitten off. The little finger of her left hand was twisted, as if broken and never reset, just healed. But her eyes shone bright and fierce. He walked with her beside him, and he wondered what was happening to Natalia Anastasia Temerovna. Fyodorovich assembled close to 1,200 of the Marine Spetsnaz. With so many personnel on duty with the fleet, he couldn't put together a larger force. He stood on the greenway, near the hedges, where the two disrobed Spetsnaz were discovered, along with the third, younger victim of this Wolfgang Heinz. Coming up the greenway from the road beyond, walking as he always did, as though he had filled his pants, was Victor Metz, head of security, head of the KGB.
Boris! I must talk with you!
Victor, certainly. Never fear. The Marine Spetsnaz have the situation in hand.
Metz stopped before Fyodorovich. He removed his black uniform cap and ran his left hand back across his thinning hair.
I consulted the chairman. I asked him, Boris, why the Committee for State Security was not called in. This is a police matter, Boris.
The missing man was a prisoner of Marine Spetsnaz.
Victor Metz shook his head.
That is another thing, that only one man is responsible for such mayhem. Who is he?
I am given to understand, Victor, that his name is Wolfgang Heinz, and he is a German intelligence officer. They must train their men well, but we have him trapped. Even if, as we believe, he has released the prisoners held in detention, not even their considerable numbers will have a chance against us.
Fyodorovich clapped his left hand against the AKM-96 assault rifle.
High-power weapons beneath the domes? Do you realize
what... I realize full well, comrade, that I have a responsibility to the people and to my men. This Heinz, or whoever he is, has firearms. We know that, and he uses them with considerable skill. Surveillance camera tapes have shown that all too well.
He is carrying at least 4 guns and much ammunition. Primitive arms, yes. They fire cased ammunition, yet effective. It would take many more stray rounds from our AKM-96s to puncture dome material. At least I should hope so.
It was warm today, and Boris Fyodorovich disliked Victor Metz intensely. The distaste only heated him more. In addition, full battle gear was habitually uncomfortable under the domes because of the humidity.
Why had the police been excluded? I demand to know, Boris!
Fyodorovich considered fleetingly what would happen to him if, by accident, his AKM-96 discharged and the resultant catastrophe claimed the life of the head of the KGB.
I act only on the orders of Comrade Major Karenin, and I would assume, based on your remarks of a moment ago, that the Comrade Major has the approval of the Triumvirate. Therefore, until I am notified otherwise, this remains a matter for the Marine Spetsnaz. Look!
Fyodorovich gestured beyond the greenway toward the ramps entering the tunnels. Armored personnel carriers were placed at regular close intervals, men clustered around them, all armed with assault rifles.
No matter from what level they exit the prison, even if they go to the maintenance level above or the research level below, they will be trapped. The entire main dome is ringed, their only way out. If they wish to remain inside the prison for weeks, they can, but they will starve to death. And, lest you be concerned, I have dispatched teams of my best men to the walkway surrounding the maintenance level to prevent full access to that level and any resultant sabotage.
You did not allow firearms there.
Fyodorovich grew tired of being patient.
They are armed with PV-26s. If they can kill sharks, they can kill men. But I have entrusted each team leader with one AKM-96 in the event its use is at once safe and necessary. Each man knows the penalty for bad judgment. So, my friend, rest easy. Come, I have a field mess set up. We can perhaps have some refreshing drink while we await the inevitable.
Fyodorovich started toward the mess shelter, knowing Metz would soon enough follow. The fellow had no choice. John Rourke edged back to the bottom of the stairwell, the men at its top having betrayed their presence with idle chatter. He hurried to the bottom of the stairs, joined by Aldridge and the other de facto leaders of the escapees.
We have a problem. Not insurmountable at the moment, but a problem nonetheless. Guards posted at the top of the stairs. And so I would imagine there are guards posted on the walkway surrounding the maintenance level. They obviously don't want us up there interfering with things, which is all the more reason to go. Probably just enough of a force to contain us down here, they think. Likely something similar on the research level below. Perhaps not. If we wish to get to maintenance in order to sabotage the electricity and cut off their cameras and then use that tunnel, we have to take out whatever force they put there.
How?
Funny you should ask. Are you conversant with the concept of a scavenger hunt?
John Rourke had a plan. In the cell block area, he saw a cage similar to the ones used in the research laboratory. In addition, chemical fire extinguishers hung along the corridors and in the cell block area. He assigned Martha to oversee assembly, using 2 dozen of the Sti-20 pistols secured between the vertical and horizontal portions of the grillwork grid. They wedged the butts of the Sti-20s between the cage sections, then tied them into place with strips of cloth from the inmates' already tattered clothing. The haft of John Rourke's grain knife was bound with 23 feet of 180-pound test cord. A certain skill was required to wind the cord to form a handle surface, a skill he learned from Jack. But no skill at all was required to unwind it. He unwound a sufficient length so that the cord could be passed through the trigger guards of each of the Sti-20s mounted together, 4 groups of 6. Because of the stirrup-style triggers, the Sti-20s were ideal for the procedure. Meanwhile, Aldridge supervised preparation of a plexiglass wall section taken from the guard cubicle near the energy barrier. Using the web belts taken from some of the overpowered prison security personnel, they secured the cage, fitted with 4 groups of 6 Sti-20s, to the plexiglass wall panel. Other belts were improvised into straps bound around the plexiglass panel. The device constructed, John Rourke stood at the head of the freedom fighters.
Here's what we're doing. I'm going into the stairwell first, using my pistols. I'll lay down some fire to send them back into cover, allowing the people with our little gadget adequate time to get into position at the base of the stairwell. The gadget, as I called it, is designed to function as both a weapon and a shield. four people will maneuver and fire the device. As these four people proceed up the stairwell, they'll be protected from enemy Sty 20 fire by the plexiglass shield, but be able to fire four separate batteries of six Sty 208s against our enemy. Once they reach the top landing, they'll take up a defensive position and retrieve any additional Sty 20s from any incapacitated security personnel. We can then reload the Sty 20s mounted on the device with magazines from the captured weapons. Meanwhile, the fire extinguisher brigade will move into position at the top of the stairwell. The device will move into the corridor for no more than 20 seconds, fire a few volleys, and as enemy fire starts, we'll pull it back. Any commander worth his salt will press the advantage and close on our force. That's when the fire extinguisher brigade goes into action. As soon as a substantial number of the enemy forces in the stairwell, open fire from that grillwork structure over the stairwell. I'll be up there too in case some of them start firing back or in case there are any live ammunition guns in the batch. If they do start to employ live ammo, stay clear because the only chance we'll have is for me to take out whoever is using the guns. Any questions?
There were none.
All right. Four volunteers, see Martha here and give the gadget a dry run. Check that the pistols are empty before you do. Remember to check the chambers.
As the mob started to break up, Rourke took Aldridge aside.
Sam, give me the operating characteristics on their assault rifles. Just in case we get hold of one, I want to know what to look out for.
Right. It's called the AKM-96, and it's a short-action firing 4.86mm caseless projectiles. Kind of a slow cyclic rate, which is good. The projectiles are armor-piercing and spin. I don't know if you're into old weapons besides those 45s of yours, but it's like the M16 assault rifle used 5 centuries ago, before they changed the rifling. The projectile turns into a little saw blade, basically. It's what they used to call a bullpup. There's a thumb hole in the stock, and the action is set back from the trigger guard. The carrying handle is a built-in optical sight.
What's the magnification?
None. Just a battle rifle, and it's never used for sniping or for much of anything over 200 yards, for sure. 40-round magazine, and the magazines are disposable. Magazine attachment is nice and positive. It's a good battle rifle. I like ours better, but theirs is good.
Well, if we get out of here like we plan, you'll have to show me one of yours.
Hell, Doctor. I'll buy one and give it to you. They owe me a couple of months back pay with hazardous duty and combat on top of it.
You're on.
John Rourke stepped into the stairwell, his right hand hurting maddeningly, but a stainless Detonics pistol in his right hand, just as in his left. He edged toward the stairs, peering upward, wanting to start out with a clean shot. It would induce more terror, just what he needed now. Shooting almost straight up was a poor proposition at best. The guards had opened the door to the stairwell. He could just see one of the men posted at the top, the man's right arm and right side of the chest cavity. Rourke stuffed the Detonics in his left hand into his belt and raised the 45 in his right hand. The bandage over his right hand was soaked through with a mixture of blood and what smelled like pus. He shifted the little 45 back into his right fist, closing his hand over the nearly smooth Packmire's.
Ah!
He cupped his right hand into his left, closed his eyes against the pain for an instant, then edged further out into the stairwell. The target was gone. He waited. Then, Rourke saw the man, a Sty 20 held lazily in the right fist, the right arm over the railing, the right side of the chest cavity exposed.
Goodbye.
Rourke whisked down the safety. Settling just below the mating of slide to frame, he pulled the first finger of his right hand slowly rearward, taking up the slack. Because of the angle from the target and the height of it over him, Rourke held high. If the bullet impacted the precise point of aim, which it most certainly would not, it would enter the right shoulder near the base of the neck. He was hoping for a center of mass hit to the chest. There was no more slack left, and he held his breath in his throat. The normally mild recoil sent tremors of pain along his right forearm. His ears rang from the gunshot in the confined space. John Rourke dodged back.
Now!
The team with the combination weapon and shield was already into position. They bolted up the stairwell, holding fire. Another fusillade of Sty 20 fire rained down, but the darts bounced harmlessly off the plexiglass. The team quickly reached the first landing. Now beside Rourke stood the men and women of the fire extinguisher brigade. Both his pistols reloaded, Rourke started up the stairs, the fire extinguisher brigade behind him. There was precious little ammunition left for them, considering the enormity of the task ahead once clear of the prison. He hung back as he reached the first landing. The team beneath the plexiglass shield opened fire with their Sty 20 barrage weapon. The combination of the Sty 20 barrage gun and Rourke's automatic weapons overpowered the stair guards and yielded a number of AKM-96 assault rifles with ammunition. A good 50 of the escapees, some of them wounded, made it to the walkway and down to the maintenance level. Some of them used the steps. Some hurtled themselves onto the backs of Soviet fighting men below them. The escapees took no prisoners as they finished their Soviet tormentors. Rourke, the knife in his left fist, the nearly fully loaded AKM-96 in his right, kept going, then stopped for a moment. He looked from side to side. Some Russians remained. But the battle was won. Bodies of prisoners and their former jailers littered the floor, hung over the walkway railings and over the handrails for the steps. He tried earlier to determine which pipes carried the electrical current for the domes and which held the emergency circuits. He crossed toward the locked control panels at the center of the maintenance level, studying the piping in greater detail. As he jogged, he reloaded his weapons, finishing the job as he reached the locked control panels. Aldridge joined him.
Open that.
Sure, Doc.
Aldridge stepped back from the panel doors. The thin cabinet material cracked. Aldridge knocked the lock away with his rifle butt. Rourke approached the panel, studying it.
All right. It looks like these control the main power supply for the domes, and these control the emergency power supply. Now, we'll need emergency lights on to get through that passageway into the Institute for Marine Studies. At least two other systems. This and this. Now, if you look here at these readouts, only the main system is showing a fluctuation in power. This one, the emergency system, is just on and that's all, ready to kick in. And this one has got less leading out of it, but is evidently in use. It must be for the electronic monitoring system. Yeah, having it on a different circuit board only stands to reason. Agree?
Oh, sure.
All right. So, we cut this one and the main power supply is off, and the emergency power supply kicks in. And I bet when we do, this other one that's in reserve kicks on. If everything here is geothermal, they won't be running anything off fossil fuel, synthetics, or nuclear. You agree?
Everything's geothermal here, that I know.
Okay, so if the geothermal energy supply just cuts out, they'd be up Schitt's Creek without a paddle. And that's when this emergency system should kick on.
Rourke shut off the main system. There was sudden inky blackness, but only for a second. Red emergency lights came on. Rourke could see the panel again.
All right, both of these reserves are activated. Now we switch this off.
He closed down the one original panel that still had unchanged power levels.
Now, let's watch which one of these goes to a higher reading and hope it's the one for the emergency startup power.
His gamble worked.
All right. Now, we kill this and they can't restart their generators without a lot of fooling around. And more important for our purposes, they can't see or hear us as we hit the trail.
Rourke shut down the third panel. The emergency lighting still worked.
Damn, what now? I mean, all they gotta do is turn on those switches and they're back in business.
Nope. Help me follow this piping in and out. Then we cut through the piping. Yeah, it's not metal. Some sort of fireproof plastic substance. We cut through it with these.
Rourke gestured to the AKM-96.
Got somebody good with electricity?
Besides you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. Get whoever it is to crosswire the three dead panels, so when they start connecting things, they not only start connecting things wrong, but they electrify the panel. Get my idea?
You want a job in the Marines when we get back?
Nah, but thanks anyway. I'm too old to enlist.
You 35 or so?
Yeah. Add 500 years to that, and you're almost there.
Rourke started walking the piping with Aldridge. Tracking the piping took almost 10 minutes, but when they were through, Rourke was satisfied, and Aldridge went off to find his electrician. Rourke took the communicator from his belt. He walked away from the area near the panels, getting as far away as he could from the moans of the injured and dying. His doctor's instincts told him he should be treating these people, but other instincts told him that if he didn't secure what remained of the operation as best he could, all of them would be dead and he would have helped no one. When he was a sufficient distance away, he opened the communicator and depressed the push-to-talk button. Aldridge joined him, and Rourke touched his finger to his lips to signal the Marine officer's silence.
All dead here. Some kind of chemical weapon coming to surface by way of research level tunnels. We followed them. Stop them! Stop them, comrades!
Rourke released the push-to-talk button.
That was cute.
Aldridge's left arm was bleeding, but not badly. The cut long, but not deep. Rourke realized it was the first he had noticed it.
Yeah, well, I hope they believe it. Let's do what we can quickly for the wounded and then get the hell out of here.
Aldridge nodded, starting back with Rourke past the electrical controls. Gunfire cut through the electrical pipes. Rourke noticed a woman working to cross-wire the panels. They returned to the base of the steps leading down from the walkway. Rourke glanced at the face of his Rolex. Time was running out for them to escape, and perhaps, too, for Natalia.
We move out in 5 minutes!
The Soviet major returned Michael's salute and dashed off. Michael looked from right to left. There were people running throughout the encampment, vehicles starting up. He'd just been given an order in Russian he didn't understand. He was beginning to get bad vibes. He threw up the tarp covering the rear of the truck and clambered in along with Paul and Otto.
Michael, if I understood that voice out there, he was ordering Paul and Otto to the assembly area at the front of the camp. Some emergency and he required personnel, I think. And if I'm right, and they don't show up...
Hang on.
He threw down the tarp. Paul looked at once nervous and resigned.
If we gotta hang around here for maybe another 6 hours or so, we don't have any choice, Michael. Next time that officer sees me or Otto or you, for that matter, we're in deep shit with him, and all of a sudden the center of attention we can't afford.
You are suggesting we go?
I don't see a heck of a lot of choice in the matter, Otto. Michael?
You don't speak Russian. What the hell are you gonna do?
Just enlisted guys, right? Who's gonna ask us anything?
Other enlisted men, that is who. This could be suicidal. But I agree, we have no choice. Michael?
Yeah, but check it out. If it goes sour, have a way out. Don't get in over your heads. It looks like...
Michael glanced out a slit in the flap toward some of the running men. They were in full battle gear. There was appropriate equipment in the truck for Paul and for Hammerschmidt.
They may be planning on being gone for a while, guys.
If we hide in the truck and that major realizes we didn't show up, or sees us after he gets back, oh boy.
Paul's eyes were pinpoints of light.
Go for it. Get your gear.
Hammerschmidt stuffed his German service pistol under his uniform tunic. Paul checked the Browning high power he carried. Maria Leuden, in the gray half-light, looked sick with worry. She hugged Hammerschmidt and then Paul.
This is madness.
You're telling me.
Paul stuffed all the spare magazines he had into his pockets.
This is crazy, but we don't have any choice.
Just don't get on any airplanes, guys.
We're gonna have to play it straight, Michael, otherwise it'll lead that major back to you. And when your dad and Natalia do show up here, there won't be anybody to get him out. We'll be cool.
Paul slipped a black-hafted Gerber MK2 fighting knife under his tunic. Hammerschmidt did the same.
Gonna be up to you and Maria now.
Paul turned for the rear of the truck bed, stopped, and looked at Michael.
Maybe I shouldn't say this, Michael, but I will. I know you want Karamazov dead for causing the death of your wife and the baby. But that isn't why we came here. Right?
Right. You've been hanging around with my father too long. You're beginning to think like him.
I take that as a compliment.
That's how I meant it.
Michael Rourke clasped Paul Rubinstein's right hand for a moment, then released it. Then he shook Otto Hammerschmidt's hand as well.
I know.
Rubinstein started through the tarp.
When you guys get back, don't hang around here too long looking for us. We may have already pulled it off. If you don't see us, rejoin Hahn and his men on the high ground.
Paul only nodded. Hammerschmidt shot Michael and Maria a salute, then followed Paul out of the truck. Maria stood beside Michael Rourke.
We might never see either of them again.
We'll see them. You stay in the truck. They might be looking for female enlisted personnel out there, too. I'm going back to check on the command tent again. So lay low.
Lay low?
Hide. Hide. Do it.
Before he left the truck, Michael checked the positions of the two Beretta pistols under his tunic. He had the uncomfortable feeling he might need them soon. The deeper Rourke, Aldridge, and their ragged band trudged into the tunnel connecting the maintenance level to the Institute for Marine Studies, the hotter and more humid it became. Pipes were everywhere along the ceiling and walls and even along the floor. Pipes carrying live steam in and electrical energy out. Some of the pipe joints dribbled scalding hot water. The floor was awash in tepid water several inches deep.
Who are you after? I mean, must be some friend.
What's so funny?
I was just thinking... You did all this for us, and you don't even know us. I could see you risking your life for a friend.
She'd do the same for me, Sam.
She, huh?
That's not why.
The red lights, the rising vapors, the wet earth smell of the place, and the intense heat were like the vision of hell John Rourke conjured in his mind when he first read Dante. Each time the service tunnel took a bend, he kept expecting to see Virgil, beckoning Rourke and the escapees to take the complete tour. Rourke decided he would decline the opportunity. And also beyond each bend, Rourke expected to see Karenin's troops waiting. Rourke again checked the luminous black face of his Rolex, smudging steam away from the crystal with his thumb just to read it. The darkness was not deep enough nor the red light bright enough for Rourke to read it easily. He had to hold his wrist up to where it nearly touched one of the ceiling-mounted emergency lights. Time was running out for Natalia, he realized. Sam Aldridge interrupted his thoughts.
You're going to break off from us and try and penetrate the officer's complex?
Yeah.
You're going to need a backup, Doctor. You did me a good turn, I'll do one for you. They had me up to the officer's quarters once.
The tunnel opened ahead, the clouds of steam thinned, and the air began to cool. Rourke shivered once as they walked on, and he noticed his liberated Soviet boots leaking like sieves. What did that matter? Natalia was imprisoned. John Rourke quickened his pace. Paul Rubinstein remembered Michael's warning not to get aboard any airplanes. As he looked at Otto Hammerschmidt, he thought the German commando captain must be thinking the same thing. But there they were, aircraft waiting in the distance across the hard-packed snowfield he, Hammerschmidt, and about 250 armed Russian soldiers were crossing. To board the planes? That seemed obvious. Trucks carried them from the main camp to one of the smaller camps. Paul judged the travel distance as about 2 miles from the main camp. They passed through this camp's ordinary tents, not the fancy hermetically sealed, climate-controlled kind used by the German forces and the similar ones used by the Russian forces. And there was a large crater around which the trucks transporting them traveled. The crater was scooped out with mounds of snow-splotched dirt near the rim and heavy construction equipment parked beside the mounds. There were buildings in various stages of construction. The shells looked nearly completed. And then there were the trucks bearing the gas Karamazov unearthed in Egypt and used against his own people in his attempt to overthrow the government of the Soviet underground city. The gas acted only on males, causing them to become enraged animals obsessed with killing. Paul turned away from the hole in the tarp through which he viewed this and tried to think of what it reminded him of. As he marched now beside Otto Hammerschmidt in ragged formation toward the airplanes, he struggled to recall a similar image, but could not. Rourke touched Aldridge on the left arm, then moved forward in a low crouch past the display case in the museum hall, the AKM-96 tight in both fists. They entered through the back door leading from a narrow stairwell into a small office, perhaps the office of the curator. A partially completed exhibit drawing lay on the desk, along with trays of paperwork. When they entered the gallery, Rourke noted with satisfaction that the watertight door he secured between the shark pen area and the display hall during his escape from Karenin was still secured. They left the remaining escapees under the command of one of Aldridge's sergeants to continue on toward the submarine pens and escape. Captain Aldridge vowed that once his band reached the dome beneath which the Soviet fleet was housed, they would create the noisiest and most attention-getting diversion possible. Sam estimated the travel time, unless they encountered serious resistance, as under 15 minutes. Rourke stood beside the doors now, the entry hall just beyond. He counted seconds, not trusting that there would be sufficient light by which to view the face of his watch.
Now!
He stepped through the doors slowly, the Soviet rifle in a hard assault position. Aldridge was beside him. A bank of three red emergency lights bathed the entry hall in blood-tinged gray shadow, the entrance to the walkway and street beyond nearly as dark. Suddenly, Rourke realized what he had done. In disabling the primary lighting system, he turned off the artificial sunlight, however it was made to work, that illuminated the domes. Outside, beyond the doors, it was night. Hugging the wall as they moved, the two men moved for the doors. As yet, there was no sound of the diversionary action.
Don't worry, they'll deliver, Doc. Pretty soon, you're gonna have one hell of a disturbance.
Yeah, we're gonna need it.
Rourke had formulated a plan, if it could be called that. But he needed panic for it to work. They were beside the doors leading to the walkway now. He reached to touch the doors. Natalia had been allowed to leave the bed. Karenin sent in two female Marine Spetsnaz, both women powerfully built, one with a leering smile, and both armed with Stai 20 pistols. Natalia received nothing to wear, so she wrapped the blanket from the bed around her, then headed down the hall to the bathroom. The women flanked her now on either side as they returned back from the bathroom along the small hall to the bedroom. If these were a senior major's accommodations, she was not eager to see enlisted barracks. The moment the two women first entered the bedroom, the smiling one watched while the other woman cut the bonds holding Natalia in the bed. For how long? Natalia knew that this might be her best possible chance to escape. The unsmiling woman wasn't that much taller than she, although considerably heavier. But the uniform would serve. Her blanket tight around her now, she stopped beside the bedroom door. The smiling woman reached past her to open the door. The smiling woman hesitated at the sound of an alarm outside, looking toward the apartment door further along the hallway. Natalia did not hesitate. Natalia's right hand caught the smiling woman's wrist, her right knee smashing up into the elbow joint. She drove the heel of her left hand up and out against the base of the second woman's nose, killing her instantly. She wheeled half right. Still unsteady on her feet, her right hand went to the doorknob for support as the sole of her left foot snapped out, catching the smiling woman's gun hand and knocking the pistol clear of her grasp. The Sty 20 scraped across the bare floor. Natalia's left foot slapped out again, the heel crushing the woman's throat. As Natalia used the doorknob to regain her balance, the door fell away and she started to fall into the bedroom. Her right shoulder hit the bedroom floor. She tried to rise. The muzzle of an assault rifle hung inches from her face.
Major, you are very good.
Natalia started to go for the muzzle of the assault rifle, but something struck her right side. She got to her knees. She could see Karenin's booted feet, hear him whisper.
We have a variety of special purpose rounds for the Sty 20, Major. The one I just used is a special psycho-D inhibitor that is combined with a mild muscle relaxant. The sensation is supposedly quite pleasant, really.
Paul Rubinstein's feet were cold, standing there in the snow within 50 yards of the cargo helicopters. Their rotors had shut down. The windows were steamed, and he could not see inside. Suddenly, the forward ranks broke off left, and the ranks just in front of him and behind him started right. Paul and Otto joined the men around them. They ran, not knowing where, but as part of a herd. After a moment or so, order grew out of the chaos. The leading ranks broke up by squads to ring the cargo helicopters to the north side of the field. And the element Paul and Otto Hammerschmidt were part of did the same with the helicopters on the south end of the field. Semicircles formed near the cargo doors as they began to open. Paul, Hammerschmidt beside him, joined the rest of the men in their squad in fixing bayonets, then going to high port. The cargo doors stood open. Men, women, children. They were all Chinese. They were all naked. They were all pushed through the cargo bay doors, down the ramps, and into the snow. Paul Rubinstein felt tears welling up in his eyes. Now he recalled what it was the camp resembled.
Oh God, Abraham, let this not be so.
But he knew it was. Hammerschmidt prodded him. Paul advanced on the naked people, their bodies shaking in the cold like leaves in the wind. Rifle butts hammered into naked backs. Kicks landed on naked legs. Spittle arched from the mouths of some of the Soviet soldiers into the startled, frightened faces. And the naked people, hundreds of them, some crying, some talking as though they were trying to say this was all some terrible mistake, some saucer-eyed in shock, were prodded forward across the snow. Women held infants, the infants' bodies blue-tinged with the cold. Some of the infants tried to suckle. As the dazed herds of humanity left the helicopters, crews shoveled human excrement from the now vacant machines. Gradually, the naked people herded together as they marched on, close to one another for warmth. A woman fell, dropping her baby. Paul started toward her to help her, realized what he was doing, and stopped. Another of the guards ran toward her, kicked at her, and brandished his bayonet toward her baby. The woman caught the baby in her arms and ran stumbling into the herd.
Oh, God, Abraham. Oh, God. I am a Jew marching naked human beings through a snowfield towards a death camp.
Paul's body shook with rage.
What are you doing, Boris Fyodorovich?
As Fyodorovich jumped inside the gull wing, he turned back to the KGB head.
I am using my brain instead of waiting for orders. Try it sometime, comrade.
He turned to his driver.
The submarine pins, now!
The Gullwing started ahead, bumping across the greenway and over the curb, just missing one of the armored personnel carriers Fyodorovich had ordered to the pens as well.
We have been tricked by that radio communication. This Wolfgang Heinz, or whoever he is, he speaks Russian, I would wager. And he tricked us. Whoever he is, this tall, lean, courageous man has so far outsmarted all of us.
Olaf Karenin would be hard put to explain it all away.
Faster!
The Gullwing moved ahead. John Rourke stepped through the doorway from the People's Institute for Marine Studies and onto the walkway. Alarms were sounding, even more loudly, it seemed, than before. The street between the walkways was jammed with fast-moving Gullwings. Most of the Gullwings had running boards with armed men perched on them, and many of the soldiers carried AKM-96 assault rifles. He tucked back into the doorway.
What the hell do we do now, Dr. Rourke?
He looked at Aldridge and smiled.
Join all the happy people. Come on!
Rourke left the doorway and crossed the walkway to the street. As the first likely-looking Gullwing passed, he jumped for the running board, his assault rifle slung under his right arm.
Come on!
But there was no time to look to see if Sam was coming. As he reached the running board, Rourke grabbed the right ear of one of the men clinging to the Gullwing. With a quick yank, the man fell away. The Gullwing bounced as the vehicle careened over the man's body. Beside him, another of the soldiers grabbed for him. Rourke turned to struggle against him and saw Sam clinging to the soldier's back, his fingertips gouging into the man's eye sockets.
Grab onto something else!
Rourke's left elbow smashed the hapless Russian in the face. The man's body fell away to the road surface. On the opposite side, the driver's side, one of the three Russians who clung there was trying to level a Stai 20 pistol. Rourke fired first. One of the other two men jumped, landing just behind the Gullwing, on his knees. The AKM-96 slung across the soldier's back came up, firing. Glass, or whatever it was that formed the rear windshield of the Gullwing, shattered. The third Russian soldier took part of his comrade's burst and fell away.
Sam! Duck!
Rourke stabbed the little detonics toward the man, bracing it on the roof. As he readied to fire, another Gullwing crashed over the kneeling soldier. Rourke swung the detonics through the rear window of the Gullwing and opened up on the half-dozen armed men and driver. He emptied his little pistol into the Gullwing. Sam hung on beside him and stabbed the muzzle of his liberated AKM-96 through the shot-out glass. The Gullwing swerved erratically now, sideswiping other vehicles on the roadway. The driver was still alive. Rourke drew the detonics from his left side holster. The Gullwing driver's right temple dotted red. The head snapped away.
Sam! Get that door handle beside you, quick!
Rourke looked back, and Sam was gone for a moment. Then the Gullwing slowed.
I made it!
The Gullwing doors were almost completely open now, and Rourke swung inside. Bodies of dead Russians littered the seats and the floor.
Turn us around! We're going the wrong way!
Yes, sir!
Rourke nearly lost his balance at the Gullwing, the door still closing. U-turned in the middle of the street, sideswiping another Gullwing. Rourke grabbed up an AKM-96 from the hands of a dead Marine Spetsnaz and rammed the muzzle through the shot-out rear windshield. He crouched in the seat, ready.
Come on, step on it, huh?
These things don't have any guts, Doctor.
Well, pretend they do. Put it to the floor and drive. Hey, you think this thing would keep rolling if we knocked the doors off, Sam?
Knock the doors off?
Hit the door controls. Come on, do it!
Hurriedly, Rourke began to relieve the dead Marine Spetsnaz personnel of their weapons. Two more AKM-96s, six Stai 20 pistols, and thankfully, spare magazines for the AKM-96s. He stuffed as many of these as he could into the magazine carrier beside his musette bag, then took a second magazine carrier from one of the dead men and began filling it for Sam. Rourke looked over his shoulder as he knelt behind the driver's seat.
Those two APCs were the third one behind him. The one with the hatch open?
You're not... Oh, my God!
That's right. Now, thread the needle right between those first two. If the doors go, they go. Now, we need to be able to clear out of this fast. You got any idea how many guys they have inside one of those APCs?
Too many, I bet, Doctor.
Rourke smiled. Sam was threading the needle.
Take your right hand off the wheel for a second.
He slipped the shoulder strap for the magazine carrier over Sam's hand, along his arm, and over his head.
Just a little something for you. Many happy returns.
Rourke eyed the two APCs.
Close your eyes when we hit and step hard on the gas.
Rourke passed his left arm across his back, sheltering the Marine as best he could with his own body, his right arm up to protect his face.
Shit!
The open Gullwing doors were torn away, and he could smell smoke. As the doors went, Rourke opened his eyes. Shards of the glass lay all around them.
Are we out of it? Step on it! Right for that third APC! Then cut left and just do what I do!
The Gullwing was on fire somewhere. He couldn't tell where. Rourke grabbed up the weapons and spare ammo. They were almost to the third APC.
Cut the wheel left, now!
The Gullwing swerved hard left. Rourke came up out of his crouch, almost losing his balance, but holding it. He was beside the ragged aperture where the right side gull wing door had been. Jagged metal was all that remained.
Close as you can to that APC, Marine!
The gull wing swerved right, and Rourke jumped. He reached for one of the handholds along the side of the bodywork and held on. Sam jumped out after him. They started for the top hatch, praying it was still open. As Rourke reached the top of the APC's superstructure, the top hatch was closing. He threw himself toward it, both hands going to the exterior hatch opening, his body weight throwing it back and away from the direction in which it was closing.
Sam! Get some fire in there now!
There was an officer's mess tent, but Michael Rourke avoided that. Instead, he walked past the command tent as often as he dared as part of his irregular patrol of the camp. As yet, there was no sign of his father or Natalia. On his third pass of the command tent, he stopped. In the open flap of the command tent stood the self-proclaimed Hero Marshal, Vladimir Karamazov, in shirt sleeves, dark slacks, and high boots, a shoulder holster under his left arm. Michael judged the distance as under 20 yards. With either or both of the military Beretta 9mm under his uniform tunic, Michael Rourke could have taken him at twice the distance. The man on whose orders Michael's wife, Madison Rourke, and their unborn child died just stood there. He was speaking with a colonel, the two of them just talking. Michael Rourke reached for his tunic. He opened one of the buttons with his gloved fingers. Michael recalled the story his father told of a man he once knew who, before the United States entered World War II, had the opportunity to kill Adolf Hitler. The man was standing less than 30 feet from the beast. The man in the story was armed and had killed before, but his orders were not to kill Hitler. Hitler lived to slaughter millions. Michael's right hand was beneath his tunic, his fingers curled around the butt of one of the Berettas. The man in John Rourke's story was Jewish. After the war, when the truth of Hitler's atrocities came to light, the man took up the same gun he carried the day he could have shot Hitler. The man turned the gun on himself, but did not kill himself. Instead, he shot his gun hand, so the hand would be forever useless. The last time John Rourke saw him, the man was working for one of the agencies that searched the world for the missing war criminals. His right hand was withered and dead. Michael tightened his fist on the butt of the Beretta. Karamazov stood there, talking, orating perhaps on his greatness, his plans for world conquest. Vladimir Karamazov just stood there. Michael Rourke wondered if someday he would shoot his own right hand. But this day he came as a rescuer, not an assassin. He turned to walk away, but looked over his shoulder once more.
Someday, Karamazov, I'll be back as an assassin.
Michael Rourke walked away. Sergeant Bill Aitken ignored the fact that some of his people were not part of the Corps. He also ignored the fact that some of them were not even Americans. He raised his AKM-96 in his right hand.
Marines! Follow me!
Aitken broke into a dead run, leading his beleaguered companions toward the Marine Spetsnaz behind the fences barricading the submarine pens. The defenses here were impressive, but built to repel any attack coming from the huge lagoon beneath which the submarines and the scout subs traveled to enter and leave the Russian stronghold. The defenses were not designed to thwart an attack from behind, from within the stronghold. Aitken's first two bursts cut down a Marine Spetsnaz officer. He was aware of the fact that had his soul inhabited a Russian body, he might have been one of these Marine Spetsnaz. He was convinced that being a Marine, a fighter, was his karma, in his blood.
Just fucking graze me.
He was at the top of the fence. He flipped over it and dropped down onto the back of a Russian armed only with a Stai 20. Aitken's people were over the fence, and he started forward again, toward where the scout subs were kept. He could run one of those, he thought, and so could most of his people. With the scout subs, maybe at least a few of them would actually get away.
Come on, Marines! This isn't some damn walk to the chow line! Hoorah!
Ahead, he could see the water. Armored personnel carriers streamed from the dome for the military complex. John Rourke knew the energy barrier was down. He cut the levers into a sharp right and stomped the APC's accelerator pedal all the way to the floorboards. The APC's rear end fishtailed. Aldridge knelt beside him, reloading his pistols for him.
We have guns like these. We officers carry them for ceremonial stuff like parades. I didn't think anybody actually shot them.
Oh yeah, well just take me as an antique collector.
Rourke's eyes were riveted to the video used to guide the APC. The tunnel leading from the command complex was nearly choked with APCs, and Rourke was going against the flow.
Hang on again. I'm using the sidewalk. It's the only way.
Rourke angled the massive vehicle right, bouncing the curb, sweeping aside a gull wing that had evidently pulled onto the sidewalk for safety. The gull wing flipped up and rolled into the path of an oncoming APC. Rourke kept driving. He could see the point where the energy barrier could be activated.
What the hell are we doing when we get inside?
Straight for the officers' residences on our left. I get out and go inside after Natalia, and...
Hey, that sounds like a Russian name.
Rourke grinned.
She's a major in the KGB, but she retired 500 years ago, and she was on our side even before that.
What?
Oh, you'll like her, don't worry. But you stay... Whoa! You stay inside and wait for me. Give me about 10 minutes tops. If we're not out, we won't be coming out.
I got your magazines loaded. You're just dead even. No more of that funny ammunition in the box.
Right. How are you for activating some of the weapons console on this sucker?
Rourke took both pistols back and stuffed them into his belt. He wouldn't be using the Sti-20s. He didn't have time to shoot people twice and then wait around for them to fall asleep.
I can do it. These aren't too different from some of our stuff. If I could read the damn language.
What you need?
That one.
Rourke took his eyes from the video screen for a split second.
That's fire control. The one next to it arms the system. You guys got death rays yet?
Death rays?
Yeah. When I was a kid, I used to see Buck Rogers science fiction movies on TV. Rogers was transported into the future and they had death rays.
We don't have any death rays. Neither do the Russians.
Yeah, well, maybe it's a good old-fashioned cannon. Any idea?
Want to find out?
Sure, but not now. Right now, we're an APC going against the flow of traffic, maybe for some reason. But if we open fire, we're the enemy. So hang in there.
The energy barrier was dead ahead. Some kind of Marine Spetsnaz traffic cop waved at them to stop. The Marine Spetsnaz jumped aside just before their APC could flatten him. Rourke crashed the APC against the plexiglass booth for the guards and pitched it into the roadbed. He brushed aside the last of the gull wings and was on open road, the officer's residence they wanted dead ahead. If Natalia was there, Karenin would be too, if he hadn't been killed by the sharks. John Rourke was on the brakes as the APC rolled over the curb and onto the lawn fronting the officer's residence.
Remember, stay here.
I came along to help you find your way inside, remember? I was there.
Rourke looked at the Marine captain.
Sam, you go inside there, you might never come out again. I couldn't have gotten this far without you. And if you stay with the APC and I do get Natalia out, then at least we got a chance to reach the submarine pens and maybe make it out. If we leave this thing unattended, we can't count on it being here to get us out. You understand?
Yeah, Doctor. Don't get killed.
I don't intend to. Now give me 10 minutes. You need my watch?
No, I can keep track of time.
Rourke started up through the hatchway.
All clear forward and aft, too. At least on the video screens.
Lock the hatch from the inside and check that all the other entryways are secure.
Yes, sir.
Rourke, bristling with weapons, slammed the hatch behind him and moved across the APC's superstructure. He jumped from the superstructure of the APC to the grass fronting the officer's residence. The entire military command dome seemed empty. A gull wing was trying for the tunnel, perhaps to join the battle by the submarine pens. The red emergency lights were a little brighter here, and there were more of them. He broke into a dead run for the main entrance. Sam told him one valuable piece of intelligence as they eluded the APCs on the streets and made for the tunnel leading into the dome. All field-grade officers were given top-floor apartments. Karenin was a major. There were a half dozen of the scout subs at dockside in the pens. Martha and Aitken, after setting up a ragged but they hoped sufficiently effective defense perimeter, asked for volunteers who felt they could crew the little subs. There was a sufficient number to handle half again as many subs as were available. Martha ordered them to board, assuming the scout subs were empty of crew. But not taking any chances, she sent a party armed with AKM-96s ahead into each of the craft first. Aitken had been mentally logging the minutes. Rourke was taking his sweet time rescuing his friend. Aitken made a decision.
Lieutenant!
Sergeant!
Martha turned to him, one of the Soviet rifles in her right fist.
Sarge?
You have things in hand here. I got something to do.
Where are you going, Sarge?
After Rourke. Like he said about the lady, she would have done the same for him. Well, he did the same for us.
Aitken slipped his rifle forward on its sling and broke into a jog trot toward the fence. When he reached the fence, he looked behind him. Feng, the Chinese, who served as their guide, two of his Marines, and another Chinese, the one who was probably some kind of spy, were tailing after him.
What the hell are you doing here?
You are their commander, not mine. And, at any event, We volunteered. These rifles are useless once our people are aboard the small submarines, so...
The Chinese smiled. Aitken just shook his head and kept moving. Fyodorovich climbed into his gull wing again. The scout subs that pulled away from the docks would have all of the escapees aboard. He leaned forward to his driver.
The military dome, and hurry!
From his belt, he took his communicator.
This is Captain Fyodorovich of the Marine Spetsnaz. I request a frequency link with naval defense. Quickly! This is a maximum priority.
The submarines could get them, even if the scout subs made it out of the lagoon and into open water. It took some time for the submarines to launch, and they could make no real speed in the lagoon. The scout subs could easily outmaneuver and outdistance them, but once out of the lagoon, there would be no chance of the scout subs evading the larger craft or defending themselves against the superior weapons. However, he knew one man would not be aboard the scout subs. He was beginning to think there was no Wolfgang Heinz of German intelligence. He had to be the John Rourke of whom the Russian woman spoke, and this John Rourke would not leave her behind. The frequency cleared.
I must speak with the duty officer for the submarine pens immediately. This is Boris Fyodorovich, Marine Spetsnaz captain, and this is a maximum priority communication. I repeat...
Aitken circled around to the far side of the scout sub pens. There were more than 24 armored personnel carriers there, some of them already moving.
So far, so good.
The crews of the APCs stood about their vehicles, their expressions ranging from intensity to boredom. The crew's individual weapons leaned against the sides of their vehicles or hung over crew members' shoulders.
That one.
Aitken gestured toward the APC nearest his five volunteers. It had a clear means of getting from the pens onto the street, and the crew looked particularly vulnerable.
Do what I do, unless I do something dumb. Move out!
The small band moved ahead, angling between the hedges separating the drive ringing the dome from the greenway on which the APCs were parked. There was no traffic on this portion of the driveway, all non-military traffic barred, he assumed, because of the military emergency. The group stopped. Aitken slung his rifle back. He gestured with his hands toward the six crewmen of the APC. His volunteers nodded, understanding, he hoped, the need for total silence. Aitken moved from the hedgerow, breaking into a crouching run, eyeballing the largest of the six men, and taking him as his own target. The Marine Spetsnaz started to turn toward him, as if sensing him. The Russian started to open his mouth, as if to cry out. Aitken slammed his full body weight against the man, hands going for the throat, thumbs closing over the windpipe. John Rourke reached the top floor, seven stories up, without encountering resistance. He knew he was walking into a trap. He stood just inside the doorway leading from the stairwell, the dim light perfect for his eyes, less perfect for the eyes of his adversaries, he hoped. He could see along the length of the hall. The nearest door bore the name of another major. Rourke almost felt like writing the Soviet High Command a thank you note for being so accommodating as to place names on the apartment doors. He reached into the case with the spare magazines for the AKM-96s, took a partially spent one, and edged a half dozen of the caseless 4.86mm cartridges from the magazine lips. He put the magazine away in the case and hefted the six cartridges. He hurled them into the hallway, across the slick-looking tiled floor. Nothing happened. Rourke glanced at his Rolex. 3 minutes gone, seven or so until Sam, if he followed orders, took the APC and ran for it. Slowly, keeping to the stairwell side, he walked ahead. On the way up the building, he peered through the small, reinforced plexiglass window in each door and saw nothing. No activity. It seemed the same here. He was beginning to think Karenin had lied, but at the time, there was no need.
She has to be here. She has to be here.
Rourke stopped. He saw the right combination of Cyrillic characters. Olaf Karenin, Major. It was the door at the end of the hallway, commanding the entire hall.
Ah, now I get it.
He stepped away from the wall, swinging the second AKM-96 forward as well. He stood in the hallway.
Karenin! I am here!
John!
Karenin! Come on!
Karenin's door swung in. Rourke stopped in mid-stride, his body tensing.
If you want the woman, John Rourke, come and get her! Now!
John, he's waiting for you!
John Rourke broke into a dead run for the door, knowing he was doing what Karenin wanted. Rourke didn't care as he threw himself through the doorway in a roll. Gunfire roared from the end of the apartment's narrow hallway. John Rourke fired both assault rifles and was up, throwing himself against the opposite wall.
You missed me, bastard!
I did not miss her!
If you killed her, you kill yourself now, because it'll be easier for you than having me do it.
He kept edging along the hallway wall. The rifle in his left fist stabbed forward into a red-tinged grayness. The rifle in his right hand raised slightly and almost against the wall.
Are you coming for me, John Rourke?
I am coming for you, Olaf Karanen! Ah!
Suddenly, the narrow hallway was bathed in brilliant light, and John Rourke could see Karanen in the doorway, an assault rifle in his fists. John Rourke stepped away from the wall, squinting against the sudden brightness. He fired, both assault rifles simultaneously. The image of Olaf Karanen shattered.
Oh, shit! A mirror!
At the far left corner of his peripheral vision, John Rourke saw the open door and started to wheel toward it and at the same time throw his body left, but Karanen's assault rifle spoke. John Rourke felt something hammering into his chest and abdomen. His body slammed back against the hallway wall as the assault rifles fell from his grasp. Rourke's body skidded along the wall. Rourke's left leg swept from under him, and he fell. Rourke grabbed for the twin stainless Detonix pistols. He stabbed his left hand forward as Karanen stepped into the hallway, then his right. Karanen wheeled toward him, the muzzle of his AKM-96 coming up.
You were easier to kill than I thought you would be. Two full-length mirrors and a field floodlight. Now the woman is mine.
John Rourke fired both Detonix pistols. Karanen's body crashed back along the wall, his AKM-96 discharging into the floor. Karanen's rifle fell from his grasp and clattered to the floor.
Die, motherfucker!
John Rourke sagged against the wall. He looked down at his stomach and the blood-drenched uniform tunic. His left lung ached, and it was hard to breathe. These were mortal wounds, he realized. Blood sprayed against his hand as he coughed. He leaned his head heavily against the wall. He had very little time until loss of blood brought on unconsciousness, then death. He let the Detonix pistol in his left hand fall to the floor, moving his left hand over his left thigh. More blood. But he didn't think anything was broken. The leg should still work. Rourke leaned forward as pain surged through him.
Natalia.
There was no answer. He forced himself to his knees. One of his little Detonix pistols was still in his right fist. The other lay on the floor beside him. The stainless steel of the two pistols splattered with his blood. No artery was hit. He would have been under a quicker death sentence if so. He found spare magazines for the pistols, and from force of habit, saved the emptied ones.
Michael.
Michael could use them if Natalia got away. She could give them to Michael. He lowered the hammers on the fresh-loaded pistols, wiped the blood from them against his right thigh, and holstered them. Rourke started to crawl toward the two AKM-96s he dropped, his head swimming, dizziness seizing him. He closed his eyes, waited until the dizziness passed. He crawled, at last reaching the first, then the second of the assault rifles. He safetied each of them, slung them cross-body this time so they couldn't be lost to him. The wound in his right arm bled slightly, a flesh wound. It seemed to extend along the length of his forearm. He wondered what happened to the bullet, or was it still inside him? It really didn't matter. There were enough bullets inside him already. One more wouldn't matter. Rourke pushed himself to his feet, falling against the wall. He pushed away from the wall, his left hand pressing hard against the wall for support. Awkwardly, he stepped over Karanen's body, nearly fell, then stopped, leaning heavily against the bedroom doorframe. Natalia lay on the bed, her perfect right cheek bruised, a rag balled in her mouth, but her head was moving.
You were right. We aren't getting out of this one. Not together, anyway.
Rourke collapsed on the bed next to Natalia. As he fell onto the bed, she opened her eyes, and she wished she were dead. His left hand moved, holding the knife in his bloodied fingers. For a moment, she was afraid for herself, and she was ashamed of that. He moved the knife perilously close to her. But in the end, he brought the primary edge of it down against the headboard where her left wrist was bound. He severed the plastic cord. She was free.
John! John!
Bags strapped to my back. It's clothes for you and your guns. Take my stuff. Give my guns to Michael. The knife. You keep the knife. And tell Sarah. Tell her. I always... She knew.
She took the knife in her left hand and cut her right wrist free, then freed her ankles. She moved her body into a fetal position beside his head and held his face against her. 5 minutes later, Natalia packed the abdominal wounds with the blanket, folded into a tight, thick rectangle, then secured it over the wounds with the uniform belt Rourke wore. The wound along his outer right forearm she bound with strips cut from the bedsheet, spraying it and the abdominal wound with the German antiseptic healing agent taken from Rourke's musette bag. The leg wounds she bandaged like the arm, spraying them as well. Neither the leg wounds nor the wound to his arm were even potentially fatal unless they were just allowed to bleed. The abdominal wounds, they were fatal. Natalia had dressed quickly in the uniform he brought for her, buckled on her L-frame revolvers, and strapped on her Balisong knife. She took both AKM-96s from him and started down the hallway to the front door of the apartment to make certain the way was clear. Natalia fired a burst into the corridor and tucked back. She returned fire and then ran back along the apartment hallway, back to the bedroom.
John, you must get up!
He was still conscious.
John, get up!
He raised his head and looked at the Rolex on his wrist.
John!
You have 2 minutes. That APC out on the lawn. He'll wait another 2 minutes.
Natalia drew him up from the bed. Her own height made it easier to hold him up, his left arm drawn over her shoulders.
Forget me. Tell Annie I love her. Tell Michael. The same. Tell Sarah I always loved her.
Never! Shut up, John! You can tell her yourself!
Rourke's left arm pulled tightly around her.
And I love you. I never loved anyone the way I love you. Leave me a gun. I'll hold them off. Get out through the window. There's a balcony out there. You can work your way down.
No!
John Rourke tried to push her away from him.
Leave me. I'm dead.
No, you are not. You taught me to never give up. So, goddammit, you can't either.
Natalia Anastasia Temerovna grabbed his left arm. He was weaving, about to collapse again. She hauled his left arm across her shoulders and started for the window. Aitken turned the stolen armored personnel carrier into the tunnel. Little traffic except for gull wings. The plexiglass guard booth at the end of the tunnel was all but destroyed, the energy barrier down, he hoped, inoperable.
Hold tight! We're going through!
He stomped the accelerator and aimed for dead center in the tunnel. The few gull wings swerved away to give him a wide berth. Aldridge cleared the tunnel. He saw an APC parked on the grass near the officer's residence on the far side of the dome. He cut left. The APC was ringed by 4 gull wings. Men hid behind the gull wings. As he watched, the APC's cannon opened fire. One of the gull wings exploded. A fireball belched toward the dome roof. At least 2 men uselessly fired assault rifles toward the APC.
Let's get our weapon systems out of those gull wings!
He'd bet Aldridge was inside the defending APC. On his video screen, he saw something happening on the top floor balcony of the officer's residence beyond the little firefight.
My God, I think that's Rourke!
John Rourke started to fall, Natalia beside him.
No! I have you, John!
He closed his eyes tight against the pain, almost stumbled again, and tried to walk with her. It was easier now to go along with her than to further delay her by insisting she leave him behind. He would likely die on the way down, or certainly inside the APC if they made it that far.
How are you feeling, John? Don't slip away from me, please!
Oh, I'm fine. I'm much better. You always were a good nurse. How much further?
Not much further. Getting through that window was the tough part, wasn't it?
He looked around them. He didn't recall getting through the window at all, but here they were on the balcony of Karenin's apartment. There had to be a doorway to it, but he hadn't seen where it was. The emergency lights were still on, and that was good. Aldridge, Martha, the Chinese, all of the escaped prisoners would be long gone by now. Still, Natalia was amazing in her adaptability, her wealth of technical knowledge. She could steal one of the little submarines. She could get away. He knew she could get away.
All right. We're at the railing, John. Now I have to make some sort of harness so I can get you down. The slings from the rifles will do it, I think.
He nodded. His mouth was terribly dry. There was a second APC down there now on the grass.
Was there cannon fire a minute ago?
Yes, that APC. The Marine you spoke about. He vaporized one of the Soviet cars. He must be pretty good. I can't wait until you introduce us. You'll do that, won't you, John?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course.
Good. Now I'm counting on you. Don't forget.
I...
He leaned forward against the railing. It was at waist height.
Oh, careful! Let me do this now. You just stand still, John.
Yes, Mother.
Natalia started putting the harness of rifle slings around him. She kissed him on the cheek. He heard something, shook his head, and turned around.
They're in the apartment, Natalia. Get out of here.
Not without you!
Rourke turned himself around, leaning against the railing now.
Give me a rifle.
She had two of them. His? She gave him a rifle. Natalia started to throw herself in front of him. John Rourke pushed her aside.
Jump for it!
Rourke lurched toward the window, the light brighter than it had ever been. He fired the AKM-96. Natalia opened up with hers. Rourke saw Fyodorovich and at least two other men coming through the window.
John!
Why did she scream? Fyodorovich had an assault rifle. Rourke couldn't bring his arms up enough to get to his guns. He was trying. He knew he was trying. Natalia screamed his name again. Or was it the same scream? Fyodorovich's rifle fired. The stupid little Stai 208 fired. John Rourke's head suddenly hurt very badly, and he knew he was falling backwards. Natalia ran toward him in slow motion, and she was moving her mouth, saying something he knew, but he couldn't hear the words. Just the tremendously loud explosion inside his head. It just kept going on and on and on, and he was falling. Natalia's fingertips touched his fingertips, and then they weren't touching, and the blur in front of his eyes was suddenly faster, and he saw the wall of the building, and he saw Natalia looking down at him, and he thought she was screaming, and then everything just stopped, and there wasn't anything anymore at all.
I think he's dead, Captain.
Damn it. We didn't come this far.
They got the woman, I know that. But I didn't hear any more gunfire.
Fuck it, we're taking him with us. Move it, Marines. Get back in the damn APC and follow orders, you and you.
He looked at the two Chinese.
Get in there with him. Keep tight on us.
Aldrich clambered up the APC's superstructure as two of his Marines hauled Rourke's body out from beneath the trees through which he fell from the top floor of the officer's residence. Rourke's face was covered with blood, and if he was breathing, Aldridge couldn't detect any sign of it. No pulse in the neck.
Shit.
He called to the Marine he left inside his APC.
Lay some rounds on that balcony now!
He didn't want to kill the woman Rourke died trying to save, but he didn't need his men shot either.
Shit!
The APC's cannon roared, and Aldridge covered his ears with both hands, the superstructure vibrating under him. Through the view screen, Aldrich saw Aitken and the two Chinese were into the other APC, pulling the hatch closed. Aldrich and his two men hoisted Rourke into a seat and strapped his body in tight.
Blow that damn balcony to hell!
Yes, sir!
The APC vibrated around him, and he lost his balance.
Shit!
Sam caught himself, then slammed into the control seat and gunned the engine. The second APC, with Bill Aitken at the controls, was already moving. Aldridge worked the levers and the APC started rolling forward and left. Aitken's APC led the way. Aldridge stomped the accelerator and followed, aiming the APC for the tunnel. Natalia crawled from where she fell as chunks of debris rained around her, her revolvers in both hands, her left leg numbing from the Stai 20 round she took. She saw him for an instant as her consciousness waned. John Rourke's body caught up in some trees, and as she watched, it slipped from the boughs that cradled it and fell to the ground below. There was no movement. There was no life. She turned away from him, firing her empty revolvers as Fyodorovich and his men charged toward her.
Kill me.
John Rourke was dead. Natalia Anastasia Tyamarovna knew she had died inside, too. Aldridge turned out of the tunnel, Aitken's APC dead ahead of him and moving fast. He worked the levers and swerved the APC into an almost too tight hook onto the right side of Aitken's APC, then accelerated, his rear end fishtailing, evening out and passing his sergeant.
How are we doing behind us? Talk to me!
Sergeant Aitken's APC is accelerating too, Captain. He's right on our tail. Don't see anything.
Belay that! Got 5, maybe 6 APCs just turning out of the tunnel and about the same number of gull wings.
These guys never give up, do they?
He knew they didn't. His people and their people had been fighting the continuing battle of World War III since the night it all went down, almost 500 years ago, if he remembered his dates right. They never gave up. You killed them, and more came. You blew up one of their submarines, and there was always another one. And now they had missiles, the nuclear ones, just like 5 centuries ago, and they'd win. He felt a familiar pressure around his eyes as he drove. Captain Sam Aldridge led a commando raid against the Stalin, one of the big ones, one of the monster submarines. And they rode the damn thing almost into port to place their explosives and hit the missile factory, but they didn't make it. They got gassed, and he awoke a prisoner. His captors played with him, using electric shock and sensory deprivation. His dreams became more horrible than being awake, worse than the horrible existence of living in a cage. Ahead stood a line of gull wings blocking the roadway and an APC behind them.
Cannon that APC! Kill it!
Yes, sir!
Sam floored the accelerator.
Fire, damn it!
Aye, aye!
The cannon fired. Smoke and fire engulfed 3 of the gull wings. The enemy armored personnel carrier fired back. Aldridge swerved his machine hard right. When the explosion came, he almost lost control, skidded, jumped the sidewalk, and sideswiped the building walls on his right. Every bone in the crew's bodies felt as if they were vibrating.
Shoot now!
His gunner fired as the Marine at the rear monitoring the video screen shouted,
They got Aiken! God damn them to all nothing!
The road surface beside the enemy APC turned into a rising fireball, gushing toward them and away from them along the tunnel ceiling. Aldridge kept the accelerator to the floorboard, threw the fireball past the enemy vehicle.
Disabled? What? Get specific!
Sergeant Aiken's APC got flipped over on its side and rammed into the far tunnel wall! The superstructure's half blown away! They got him, Captain! The motherfuckers!
Let's see they don't get us! I'm sorry, Herb.
He glanced at the Marine beside him.
You making it, Bernie?
Yes, sir, making it. Just.
Aldridge could see the fence ahead. There were gull wings there, and there were troops behind every imaginable sort of barricade, and there was a phalanx of APCs closing from the right. He cut left, jumped the curb, punched the Russian machine through the fence leading to the main sub pens. He was starting to slow since he was traversing ground now and not the hard road surface.
APC's closing fast, Captain! Those other 6 are still dead behind us!
Just pray the guns and the scout subs are waiting for us and be ready to move!
How about the dead guy, sir?
Aldridge looked at Corporal Bernie Richter.
The body goes with us, right?
Yes, sir!
Aldridge could see the tunnel between the scout pens and the lagoon dead ahead. Nothing beyond 2 gull wings blocked it.
Vaporize him, Bernie!
You got it, Captain!
The cannon fired. The pulse of the thing made the superstructure vibrate, the 2 gull wings vanishing in a ball of flame the next instant. Aldridge drove through the flames, knowing he couldn't stop now.
Getting a readout off the rear tires, Captain! They're hot! Shit! They're on fire!
Hang in there, Herb!
He realized his knuckles were going stiff on the levers. His neck ached, his eyes burned because he couldn't blink. It was a narrow walkway here, not made for traffic at all. He bounced a curb.
Be ready! Come on, baby!
He was starting to lose the steering. The lagoon was dead ahead, just beyond another APC.
Fire around it! Make a ring around it! Do it now!
The APC shook almost out of control as Aldridge slowed her, the lagoon less than 100 yards ahead.
Now! Hold on to something tight!
The APC fishtailed, the rear end swept right. The crew braced. If Sam did it right, maybe they wouldn't die just yet.
You hit the thing, sir! Shit! She's gone into the lagoon!
Out!
Aldridge hit his seatbelt release and slid from behind the controls, their APC smoking, on fire. Flames licked from some of the overhead panels. And he could smell burning insulation. He released Rourke's harness and grabbed up Rourke's body.
Up the hatch! Watch for enemy fire and grab him!
Right, sir!
Richter disappeared through the hatchway as Herb Kozlowski helped Aldridge with the dead man.
Ready, sir!
They pushed Rourke's body through the hatchway.
Got him, sir! Sir, we got company! Those damn APCs!
Aldridge was the next one up, the AKM-96 going ahead of him. They were 10 yards from the water.
Pass him down!
His 2 Marines slid Rourke's body down. Aldridge got the body over his right shoulder. It was stupid, hauling a dead body. He did it anyway, running, his 2 men outdistancing him, dropping into kneeling positions beside the water at the end of the dockside. Gunfire tore into the dock bumpers.
Into the water, guys! Move it now!
Aldridge tossed his rifle away and jumped. letting the body slip from his shoulder as he hit the water, tucked down. He never liked diving. He opened his eyes. Rourke's body wasn't floating. As Aldridge's head broke the surface, he dragged Rourke up.
He's alive, damn it! All right!
Sam grabbed Rourke across the chest and under the left armpit.
If you can hear me, take a deep breath, Rourke!
Aldridge pulled Rourke with him under the surface. Air escaped Rourke's mouth in great bubbles.
The damn APC's firing.
Sam broke the surface and saw two of the monster subs crossing the lagoon. Aldridge could see Richter, but not Herb Kowalski.
Herb! Where are you? Kowalski! Kowalski!
Captain!
Aldridge swallowed water. Sam twisted in the churning lagoon. One of the scout subs came dead on for them. But Aldridge could see Martha on the deck, another of the escapees at the deck gun opened fire. Martha disobeyed orders being in this close. He'd kill her after he kissed her. He swam to the sub. A line snaked out. He caught the coil with his right hand and twisted the coil around his upper body and roars.
Reel us in! Get him first! He's still alive! Or he was a second ago!
Aldridge slipped the rope from his own body, shoving Rourke up under the rail. Martha and another woman and a Chinese reached for him.
Get him some mouth-to-mouth! He could have a shot-out lung! Be careful!
Aldridge was halfway up himself when the hands reached for him and he fell forward to his knees onto the deck plates. APCs fired from the dock. Monster subs closed with both their deck guns firing.
Richter and Kowalski, you see him?
Martha turned away from him, snaking up the line again. Aldridge vomited up water across the deck plates, then looked after her. There was something wrong with Richter. The same rope that reeled Sam in hauled in the other two Marines. He grabbed the rope and started to pull. Richter came up first. His left arm was limp and his mouth trickled blood. As Aldridge and Martha reached down to Kowalski, the deck guns of the monster subs opened up again. Kowalski's body jerked, slammed against the scout sub, then fell away.
Kowalski!
He's dead, Sam! Come on!
Aldridge looked at his lieutenant, then back to the water. He could see Kowalski floating face down. Aldridge clambered to his feet, lurched toward the deck gun, shoved the Marine away from it, and swung it around.
Eat shit, you bastards!
He started pumping the deck gun, the pounding of it something he could feel. Martha hammered him with her fists.
Damn it, Captain! You gonna stay up and swim?
He looked at her.
Lieutenant, you got balls. Let's get below.
He secured the deck gun and headed for the main hatch. They were going home. Survivalist Midwake is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 1988, Jerry Ahern. Published by arrangement with Jerry and Sharon Ahern. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2009, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Thomas Penny, Eric Messner, Nanette Savard, Elizabeth Jernigan, David Coyne, Michael Glenn, M.B. Van Dorn, Michael John Casey, Richard Rowan, Michael Replogle, Dylan Lynch, Ren Casey, Colleen Delaney, Kate Foster, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Timothy Hayes Lynch. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Brian Rogers and Greg Reinfeld. Adapted for graphic audio by Timothy Lynch. If you enjoyed The Survivalist, be sure to look for Ryder Stacey's Doomsday Warrior, available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another Graphic Audio title.
Graphic Audio presents DC Comics Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Be careful, Barry.
Don't worry, I'll be right back.
My God.
Why am I brought from universe to universe to watch its destruction?
Anyone have any idea what this is about?
I am the Monitor, and I brought you here to save the multiverse.
Only then, in a single
swift and surprising stroke.
I will kill the man I love.
Damn you! I just wanted to see her one more time!
This is war, Superman.
No! This ends now!
Why are you fighting me? You're already dead!
I need more power! I need more strength!
It is time for you, your worlds, and your universes to die!
Iris.
Crisis on Infinite Earths and all names, characters, and elements are trademarks of DC Comics. Copyright 2009 DC Comics. All rights reserved.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.